Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 57, section 5, which is old single column, page 655. Okay, so made it through all of the precursors. Now, this is supposedly the origin of Urantia. The precursors was getting the sun into existence, getting our star into existence, technically, and we're about to read the story of how it becomes the sun of a system of planets, and then habitation eventually. But it took us a very long time to get to the point where, we basically think of things beginning, and we'll see right away as we start reading this section that it's not just all of this vast, almost trillion year precursor to the Earth that science is completely oblivious to. Even in the basic aspects of how our solar system came to be is very much not understood, despite the fact that there are many glaring facts that would lead them in a more productive direction from their current theories, and they just seem to conveniently blind themselves to those facts, and you'll see that the revelators in between the lines point out some of those issues. They don't literally say, "So why are you guys ignoring that fact?" But almost to the point of saying that. Let me just, since it's right in the title of this section, let me just bring that up front. We have to get in a ways before we literally have the official designation of our solar system as "quote unquote" Monmasha. What that means literally is the mother place of man. Man, mother, place. In that order, etymologically in the word. In other words, and we'll talk about that in context when we get there, we are definitely moving into a situation where it's not just, there's all of these natural physical processes going on, and with the Andromeda Nebula, and stuff is being thrown everywhere, and stuff seems to be settling down, and then there's huge disruptions. You remember we have all that. We are definitely focusing in on something now that is going to be taken control of quite definitively, so that it can be a domain where will creatures going to eventually evolve. Something that's stable enough and sheltered enough, protected enough from the harshness of the story that we've just been reading, previous to this section. Okay, so just noticing the etymology of that word, it's not just some random pronounceable sequence of letters that means your solar system any more than Urantia, is that. Urantia means your heavenly place, from our perspective, our heavenly place. Our place in the heavens, our place in the cosmos. So these aren't factual names, right? I mean, it's a revelation of truth. Right, the coinage of the names themselves is trying to take it out of just this hopelessly materialistic, philosophically materialistic worldview, that all there is blobs of matter. And you name some of them for some reason. There's a truth to all this, and the universe was created to be inhabited. Eventually, all places in the super universe level will be places for man, quote unquote, places for creatures. Just like Havona, you know, just like the central universe. There's no, you know, wild, wild west parts of the central universe that really aren't very pleasant to try to eke out a living in yet, right? Yeah. Okay. So, just, you know, we're definitely getting into, we have the factual picture, but we want to start really thinking about the truth of it all. You know, the only really hint we got along those lines is when they threw in 300 billion years ago with, you know, Michael and crew coming out and, you know, but other than that, it's all been pretty much just, you know, thinking about matter and swirls and whatnot. Yeah, so.
What's Mon Mesha again?
Okay, the mother place of man.
M-O-N is the mother?
M-A is Ma, mother.
Oh, mother, okay,
Ma. Yeah, and M-O-N is an older spelling of man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Man, mother.
Man, place. Mother, place, see. The TIA suffix is the impersonal suffix that they coined, is a modification of our IA suffix. Right, so, yep, so that so you're going to have this, you know, like I said, I'll explain it in greater detail why they specifically say mother place, but it, obviously that's hinting at some sort of carving out a sheltered place, right? Okay, so let's see what they say here.
5. Origin of Mon Mesha, the Urantia solar system. 5 billion years ago, your sun was a comparatively isolated blazing orb, having gathered to itself most of the nearby circulating matter of space, remnants of the recent upheaval which attended its own birth.
Okay, so that just that one little statement is to lay down the marker. Don't think about this like you know, you've heard this story from current scientists. There was a lot of, you know, confusion, like we were just reading. Stuff was being spewed all over the place. But, you know, it's 1 billion years have gone by now since, you know, our sun was initially established. And so all of that debris has basically been swallowed up by the stars that were formed. And it's a relatively clear region around our star. You don't have some big cloud, you know, of gas and dust, you know, that is going to condense into a central star and a disk that'll eventually develop into planets. That's not how our solar system was formed. What was that?
A lot like it looks now, as far as
now there's. As you go way out in our, you know, from our star outside of the planets, there is a lot of debris out there we recognize now. But that's recent debris from the event that gave rise to the solar system. It's not from way, way back, you know, with the formation of the stars of the Andromeda Nebula itself. So they're pointing that out. You don't think that you have some, you know, vast cloud that you're in and the sun is going to form and a few things like they currently think. You know, this is, it's all just this beautiful spherical star kind of in the middle of nothing, sitting there happily chugging along. Okay, you know, but of course it says comparatively isolated, right? I mean, again, you know, I mean, it's all relative, but it, relatively speaking, it's a cleared space. All right, and I think, let's see, I'm trying to decide if, let's wait until we get to 4.5 billion, and then I'll bring in the issues of the times here, the time scale. Let's just kind of, at this point, just stick with, you know, we were chugging along with those, that sequence of dates, and we got to 6 billion, and now we've gone to 5 billion, and don't think about how that matches up with anything humans currently think about the ages of stuff yet. Just think of it as the sequence of numbers that they've given you, as if you don't know whether or not those numbers sound appropriate or not. Okay? And then let's get a little bit more here first.
Today, your sun has achieved relative stability, but its 11.5-year sunspot cycles betray that it was a variable star in its youth. In the early days of your sun, the continued contraction and consequent gradual increase of temperature initiated tremendous convulsions on its surface. These titanic heaves required 3.5 days to complete a cycle of varying brightness. This variable state, this periodic pulsation, rendered your sun highly responsive to certain outside influences, which were to be shortly encountered.
Okay, now, all right, so the space is pretty cleared up, and there hasn't been, you know, 1 billion years have gone by, but, you know, our sun hasn't totally settled into as quiescent a mode as we know it now. However, when current scientists think about the formation of the solar system and the Earth, you know, and they're thinking about the sun forming at the same time as the Earth is forming, so that the sun is extremely young at the point you have an Earth formed and a surface and wanting to have things happening, have geology happening on that surface and that sort of stuff. You know, you've got this very young, dim star. Okay, you don't have that problem, like they currently think is a big problem, where it's going to be way too cold on the Earth yet because the sun is still so young. The sun is pretty established as a gleaming orb in the sky, right? But it is a variable star, okay, which they don't appreciate, that it started out as a quite definitive variable star, like lots of stars that we see in the sky. And it's just this is sort of the simple way the star is variable. It hasn't totally settled down yet, and it's contracting. It heats up, that puffs it out again, it cools it off. It contracts, it heats up, it puffs it out again, and so it's just oscillating, in size, in volume, in a very regular way. Then just pointing out that even though it doesn't pulse in volume, like that now, there are still periodicities of a holistic nature to our star. And it's kind of interesting that they do toss in that, the sunspot cycles aren't precisely all the same length of time, but you can kind of think about an average. But we haven't been studying it for that long. So our idea of the average is we only have a few hundred years of observation to figure out an average. You can't help but wonder if maybe if you think about, thousands or tens of thousands of years or something, like they are here, perhaps, maybe on average 11 and a half is a little bit better. Say an 11, maybe. Maybe we think it's 11 right now. Maybe over a longer span, maybe they're giving you a little hint there of something we can't really know. It's kind of base mode is 11 and a half years, and there's variations about that. They may be giving you a little science hint there that could tell you something about the dynamics. You notice they don't get into what causes the sunspot cycle or the other things that are varying with the sunspot cycle, because we need to figure that out. But we all know they give us clues that they can. So that's just a little thing that you can notice on the side. Yep.
So are they? I mean, they're connecting the 3.5 day period of its pulsation to the 11.5 year thing now, right?
Yeah. That in other words, there are still periodic variations. It's just they aren't of this kind of gross radius sort of character, more internal.
Isn't that saying it went from 3.5 days?
Right. So they're saying, so as it evolved and that it got more internalized, it's obviously lengthening in period. Yeah, that's what they're getting at. So there's some kind of quote unquote friction to it, see? And in some way, if you want to be kind of crude about it, something is dragging it out to a longer scale. So that all seems reasonable, it would get longer and longer and longer until maybe it really settles down. Probably it won't completely settle down in any way naturally before the master physical controllers really take a hold of it and really clamp it down and make it a sort of a rock solid, precisely stable phenomenon when they talk about encircling stars, right? Yeah.
Eternalize.
Yeah, but yeah, and kind of internalize it, you know, the star. Put the star into light and life, you know, if you will, or, you know, however you want to think about it.
It's really boring.
And, of course, very much, like we've pointed out, I mean, it's appropriate to call that a sun, so that you have SUNs and SONs, and it's a power personality synthesis, you know, that you're really moving towards, where the sun and whatever planets will be part of the long, you know, the ongoing solar system. We have no idea what this the future is like, but in some way it's going to end up Havona-like, that the things and the beings are totally together in some coordinated way. All right, so that's, you know, so there's a lot of fun things here. See, again, there's no way we could know that it used to, you know, have a 3 1/2 day period and be a variable star. I mean, there's no way we, you know, we can know that, but so they can tell us that, you know, and those who would then study the science of it, you know, would have that data point, you know, to try to anchor their various possibilities of rationalizing our star. And we're not, you know, we're going to try to avoid going into the science of a lot of this, you know, in general. We don't want to try to get bogged down in all those sorts of details. But remember, basically every paragraph you're reading is going to be some sort of a starting point for a scientific investigation, you know, that would have that, you know, that anchor point, the data in that paragraph is an anchor point for constraining your scientific speculations. All right. So that's, you know, that's always going to be there. And occasionally there's a really shiny object that we'll point out like that. But in general, we won't, you know, belabor the point. All right, let's get into a little bit more here.
Thus was the stage of local space set for the unique origin of Mon Masha, that being the name of your sun's planetary family, the solar system to which your world belongs. Less than 1% of the planetary systems of Orvantan have had a similar origin.
Okay, even though they italicized Mon Masha there, you know, it seems like maybe it's the official introduction. I mean, if you flip forward you know, a couple pages, I mean, way up at 3 billion years, you'll see is when it officially gets this name. So we'll, like I said, we'll deal with it officially there. I kind of already introduced it basically, but just, you know, in temporal context, we'll talk about the why of that name. Okay, so the one thing you do notice in that, though, thus was the stage of local space set. You know, you can see that they're definitely speaking about the beings that are in charge of stuff, really focusing in, okay, on this location. You know, we're going to start, you know, they're obviously going to be doing really big picture, roughing it out, you know, issues, and more they would be zeroing in, you know, 300 billion years ago, 200 billion years ago, they were obviously focusing in and getting things really clamped down in some areas because you had the first inhabited planets way back then. And now, you know, they're doing it here. They're obviously really focusing in, you know, trying to get this very specific location as it needs to be. And, you know, you may recall as you get deeper into these papers on the evolution of life, they have whole sections on these environmental issues that that they're sort of alluding to between the lines here, of thinking about all these things that we know and don't know about that are going to have to be appropriate to eventually have inhabited planets in this region of space. Let's see, anything else there? Just, you know, the bit about less than 1%. Do you remember way back, let's see, that's in paper 41, I think it is, way, way back there, when they talked about all different ways that various as astronomical objects can come into existence. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you can hearken back and remind yourself of some of the other ways that are more typical than this very, you know, infrequent way of that they're about to describe. our solar system coming into existence. Yeah, the way that current science thinks that our solar system came into existence, some solar systems do come into existence that way, but not ours. Okay. All right. What gave rise to ours, again, is something that there's no way we could ever figure out ourselves. You know, so they can just tell us it. All right, let's see what they say here.
4,500,000,000 years ago, the enormous Angana system began its approach to the neighborhood of this solitary sun. The center of this great system was a dark giant of space, solid, highly charged, and possessing tremendous gravity pull.
Okay, so let's start with the words first, and then we'll get to the number, the age there, the date. Okay, and another thing. Okay, they've got Monmasha, now they've got Angana, and again, I'll remind everyone. You can always have a copy of the etymology, and you can flip in there. Let's see, Monmasha's on the second page, Angana's on the third page, and some of these that I have figured out. The ones that when they coin ones that end where they just use that that suffix a, the first declension nominative, just Latin suffixes, the most generic sort of a suffix to make a noun. That's there to indicate that you kind of have to fill in the blank a little bit, besides what's immediately in the etymology. But and gone, okay, that part. A-N, or shortened to A, those articles. That means one, or primary, or first, okay? So here it means primary. And the G-O-N, I mean, that's generator. So the literalness, it means the primary generator of the solar system. That of the solar system part, right, is sort of just implicit in the A suffix to make it a noun. You have to think about the primary generator in what context, right, in this context.
Now, it says it was a system. Was it a solar system also?
Okay, so yeah, so you've got this dark island, and as they were, notice how they describe it. They're enormous, okay? It's got lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of planets, orbiting around it, and other stuff, all kinds of matter, in orbits, way, way, way out, because it's
no light.
Right. Right, but it's not a star. It's a dark island.
It wouldn't be a solar system.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't. It wouldn't be for those that need a star. They need light. Okay. Yeah, maybe non-breathers, right, or things like that.
Planetary
right?
system. Do you think it swung out of the Andromeda also? Probably.
No. No. Extremely unlikely. It has anything to do with Andromeda. Because, to have a big dark island like that, that's some very, very old object. Much older than...
It just happens to be in this life.
Right, it was... Again, remember, they've collected a whole bunch of stuff together to make Nebadon. This is one of the things. This Angana system is part of Nebadon. And it's got a path that it's following, and it's going to go by our lowly, little, lonely sun... here and have a near collision with it, but it's some vast system with lots and lots and lots of things in orbit about it, and again if nothing else like right here in print, if you're still thinking that black holes aren't illogical and hence don't exist, if you still think somehow the Urantia book is validating this notion of black holes, what does it say there? Solid. Okay, black holes are not solid. They're an infinitely deep hole. There's no surface. There's no solidity. If nothing else, even if you can't see why logically a black hole can't exist, You should at least be able to tell that the dark islands are not black holes by statements like that. Right? He said to me, just the fact they call them an island is telling you that they're solid. Right? You have this solid, and it's highly charged. Okay, and I don't mean like electrically charged. Charged in the more generalized sense, like the first charge of space. It's this massive object with lots of energy related to it, you know, all kinds of ways we don't even understand right now. But right here, all we need to recognize is that it's a very, very massive object. It's going to exert a tremendous gravitational influence, even if it doesn't get that close to our star. It's gigantic. You know, it's going to be many, 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 many solar masses, this object. Right? So it is going to exert some serious tidal effects, gravitational effects on this, on our star, on our sun.
Which is already kind of convulsing anyway.
Right. Which you can, yeah. So you can, you know, that's where they're going to go next. They're putting two and two together. Take something that is already, you know, having a tendency to fluff out and get a little bit, you know, not have a, as tight a grip on stuff, and then send something past that wants to pull on that even more, right? So tremendous, you know, possessing tremendous gravity pull. You know, it'd be fun to know just how many things were in orbit, and there could have been some really, really huge planets to that thing and stuff too. Anyway. Right, but the thing that's really catches the attention of anyone who has heard any scientific discussion of the origin of the Earth is that date. When you see 4.5 billion years ago, your first thought is, "Oh, look at that! That's exactly what we think that the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago." Okay, well, first of all, is it not obvious that that story that current scientists tell, or astronomers tell, you had just this cloud and it just condensed and the sun and all the planets formed all at the same time, and we say that. That happened 4.5 billion years ago. You're obviously talking about a very different event in that human story to this event. Okay, so you could at least notice that even though the numbers are the same, they're describing very different events. So you know it may not be you know you it may be apples and oranges you're comparing here. But the thing that you don't really notice here yet, but you do notice as you start going forward in these papers and looking at this endless sequence of dates that they lay out like this, is they aren't the dates that we think. You know, when they say that Jurassic started at such and such a date, and you look up where humans say that started, they're not the same date.
Okay. Otherwise, they wouldn't tell us.
If we could get the correct date, they wouldn't be allowed to tell us. But they tell us and tell us and tell us and tell us dates. That's telling you something. Remember what? Even though they haven't talked about it in detail, they did give you that little hint. Thus was the stage of local space set. Like I said, that thought that. There's this issue of how calm the local space is. And we've been talking about all of these incredible energy phenomena that gave rise to the formation of our star. And the thing that they didn't talk about here immediately, but they reminded you of back there in those papers about the physics and the astronomy, is there is lots of energetic phenomena going on besides what currently meets the eye of our observation. Lots and lots of sub-electronic energy activity. And remember how we talked about that? That has an impact on radioactivity. Okay. We currently think that radioactivity is a magic phenomenon, that it has no cause. That, of course, is false. Everything has a cause. If that atom is coming apart, something is breaking it. It isn't just falling apart because, like we currently rationalize it, as doing, that it's inherently unstable. No, it's being destabilized by something, and it's breaking apart. It's all that sub-electronic energy impinging upon it, making the fluffiness of that structure come apart and get pared down to something more solid, a smaller, more integrous atom. Okay. So think about, we're in this very early stage. It's not just the electronic level stuff that is still in quite a bit of chaos. Obviously, that sub-electronic must be much more intense way back here. In other words, we currently think of radioactive atoms. Those atoms decayed faster back then than they do now, because they were under greater assault back then than now. Especially as we, get a little further when we talk about Mon Masha, carving out a shielded space, right? Way back then, things were under very heavy assault. Even not so far back as this, they were still under very heavy assault. As we get forward in the story a little bit, we'll discover that what was actually just a billion years ago, when we use that radiometric dating method, that assumes that the decay of particular atoms has been going on at a constant rate the whole time it's been decaying, when we assume that constant rate, we get an answer for, instead of a billion years old, we get 4 billion years old. It's off by a factor of 4 way back in these early times. And maybe even here, maybe it's even more than 4. I can't, we don't know. Because, we get a radiometric date of 4.5 billion years ago. That's not this 4.5 billion years ago. That's a little bit more than a billion years ago, actually. That so-called 4.5 billion year old. So, when they're using just radiometric dates and lots of very magical thoughts about solar systems forming to say that the solar system is 4.5 billion years old, okay, it has nothing to do with this 4.5 billion. This is, at least 4.5 times 4, okay, billion years old in terms of our radiometric dating scale.
We were aging something from
this
date, it would appear to be way more.
If we really had something that we could date from this long ago, we would get a number pushing towards 20 billion years ago, which is older than they think that the universe is,
Screw up their age of the universe.
Right. and like I said...
We've only recently started measuring this in times.
And like I said, I don't want to get into the science issues, but
we'll eventually get better, I would think,
but it can only go so far. I mean, again,
with revelation.
With the revelation, so you can calibrate the radiometric dating. Radiometric dating is a very useful tool. It can be quite precise. Even with its issues, but it can't be accurate unless you properly calibrate it. And without the revelation, you can't properly calibrate it. So it's like a weight scale, for your body weight, that it'll give you 20 decimal places, But, you know, where the zero is just randomly set somewhere. Okay? It's precise, but it's not accurate. We've got that issue with the radiometric dating. And there's no way we can make it accurate. There's no way we can we can figure out what we need to know unless someone tells us. And they're telling us.
So staying on that for 2 seconds.
Okay.
The whole concept of revelation, whether it be the Urantia book Revelation and or teacher sons or all kinds of other revelations that happen, you know, agog once you're in seventh state or have happened.
Yeah.
All those particular revelations would have given people the information like this that they couldn't have gotten on their own.
Right.
So speaks, that's why they can progress so well.
And what Kalagastya did to be in rebellion is started to try to give people things that they can get on their own.
Way ahead of time.
Way ahead of time, see? And that's not appropriate. He was trying to give them light and life things by fiat rather than through the evolutionary process.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so it's always true. It doesn't matter if it's Jesus or who it is. They are constrained to put themselves in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, to put themselves in cooperative subordination to the whole, you know, and the evolution of that whole.
So okay. All of life, all the planets, are all, you know, have to go through the process of getting revelation in order to really advance.
Yep.
Because evolution just won't do it to that degree, correct?
Right. And normally, these science issues like this would be given by Adam and Eve of the planet.
But we already know all this.
Right. We would all have all this pinned down.
I gotcha.
You know, way back, you know, 10,000 BC. Right.
We would be really fancy right now.
Yeah. And normally after 25,000 years of the Adam and Eve, you've got you just have a couple of I's and a handful of T's, you know, to dot and cross left in science. I mean, you've got an advanced ultimatonic level science, and, you know, Adam and Eve have given the people all of the things, the initial assumptions, the frameworks that you need to flesh out a science logically and completely. And right, so in our case, that would be 10,000 BC after 25,000 years, you know, that we would have had this incredible knowledge.
Way more than a biologic uplift.
Yeah, and especially on a world like ours where it's a decimal planet and there's lots of things that are kind of out of the norm, you know, you're definitely going to need someone to explain to you, like, exactly how life evolved, because it's all very confusing. There's all these dead ends and tangents and whatnot on a decimal world, and you know, you just staring at fossils, you can't sort it all out. So the Adam and Eve, you know, give you some, you know, behind the fossils information.
Properly run Dalmatia would do the same.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, Dalmatia would be participating in it, but the Adam and Eve really take the lead. In the science part of the civilization, you know, the planetary headquarters is more kind of general civilization issues, and the Adam and Eve really focus in on the science and technology. Yeah, but you remember how they were giving trying to give them rudimentary science and technology with the prince's staff, right? Yeah. All right. So just appreciate we're still. Don't think that we have now gotten to the point in the story where it's kind of paralleling what humans talk about. We're still way back before. The actual story that humans tell based upon radiometric dating doesn't start until we get to a billion years ago in the Urantia book here, okay, basically. This is still way back in the mists of our ignorance. Okay, let's see. Anything else we need to mention there? Let's see. Oh, I mean, maybe just one little side note. Remember how I pointed out they call it Angana, and that means primary generator?
Yeah.
You know, just to say primary, it's like, well, what about secondary, tertiary? You know, it's a complex thing. Many things have gone into making the solar system in all of its details. Like it is, but the basic issues of the solar system are there because of what this passing massive object did. You know, and then other issues have, you know, have done little modifications and whatnot. I mean, this is a long time ago. So, you know, the sun has moved through a lot of space over all those billions of years. It's undoubtedly, you know, gone through regions that are different than it was in, you know, back here, and that would have had some impacts on the solar system. Right. So there's secondary, tertiary, you know, whatnot, you know. Nth order, you know, details. But the primary reason for the solar system being what it is because of this system. Okay. All right. Let's get some more here.
As Angana more closely approached the sun, at moments of maximum expansion during solar pulsations, streams of gaseous material were shot out into space as gigantic solar tongues. At first, these flaming gas tongues would invariably fall back into the sun. But as Angana drew nearer and nearer, the gravity pull of the gigantic visitor became so great that these tongues of gas would break off at certain points, the roots falling back into the sun, while the outer sections would become detached to form independent bodies of matter, solar meteorites, which immediately started to revolve about the sun in elliptical orbits of their own.
Okay, so remember we had a big version of that back when we were talking about this the central bulge of the Andromeda Nebula, where it went to this, you know, where he said, like, envision those pictures you see of the sun, you know, where big plumes of gas are coming out and falling back down again. See, so it's in that mode, you know, very much so, and in an even more disturbed fashion than the sun right now. Big amounts of, you know, are welling up, and, you know, but they basically fall back down again until finally, you know, the Angana is close enough that it's pulling on it enough where, you know, it breaks off a chunk of it, really, effect, you know, to a degree, and that blob of gas goes into orbit about the sun. Okay, and notice how they're calling them solar meteorites, quote unquote. Okay, don't think, you know, some blob of, you know, of rock, like we, you know, think of a meteorite now landing on the Earth. I mean, this is obviously just a big blob of gas. You know, it's not a stony meteorite or a, you know, or whatnot. But they do call them meteorites, and that ought to get you to think, well, why would they even use that term? I mean, isn't that confusing? Well, when you talk about meteorology, are you talking about rocks, flaming rocks hitting the Earth? You know, is the meteorologist on, you know, before the sportscaster talking about the flaming rocks coming in? I mean, what's the, you know, what's that word about? You know, the word meteor, what is it really referring to? It's, you know, it literally means basically things in the air. Meteorology is the logic of the things in the air. See, and you know the revelators are always using a more literal, generalized, if you will, sense of words. You know, they are things that are now in the air, if you will, you know, of the sun. You know, they're a phenomenon above the surface, right, in the extended domain, you know, from the sun. So there's a validity to referring things like that, even though we don't, you know, use that term that way. You know, and if, you know, if you wanted to think about it in precise scientific terms now, they distinguish between meteorites, meteors, and meteoroids. And a meteoroid is like an asteroid, only small. You know, so it's this object that's in orbit about the sun, this little object, you know, and if it, you know, falls into our atmosphere and starts to burn up, we call it a meteor, and if there's anything left and it hits the ground, we call that rock on the ground a meteorite. See, they're obviously not using, you know, using that terminology. Like I said, they're, you know, just, they're retooling that word from our very narrow specificity, just like they do with force, energy, power, know, instead of coining another word, it's like, you know, that one is still effective. Like I said, you can easily tell that. Meteorology, I should remind you, that word should remind you that it's not all about rocks falling from the sky. And you notice they don't call them solar meteors, they call them solar meteorites. Just as a way of, adding that suffix to emphasize that you want to really think of it as an object now. Not a phenomenon, sort of, but, you know, a literal object to give it more a concreteness by adding that suffix. You've got this object, this ball of gas, this little ball of gas that's been broken off, that's in orbit about the sun.
Big burp.
Okay? Okay? So,
yeah. I was going to go the other way, but...
Yep.
Well, it seems kind of curious. Like, they kind of went out of their way to put another clause in there. They could have just said independent bodies of matter, which immediately started revolving. They had to throw two more words in there and say solar meteorite.
They never miss an opportunity to try to challenge you out of some sort of simplistic, overly factualized nomenclature and worldview. Now, at points like that, it's like what Jesus would do with the parables. He put something out there where those who want an easy out have it, but those who know that this is true, even if that sounds initially absurd, and will reflect longer and harder and sort it out, you know, can. For those that, you know, had no inclination to really recognize what Jesus was saying, if he was making it easy for them to just, where they could just dismiss him out of hand and off they'd go, you know, and not have to fret about it anymore, right? It's for those who have ears to hear, not for all ears. And that was a dispensational revelation. This is not a dispensational revelation. It's even, you know, even for a smaller subset of ears that can hear. Right? And they throw in things like that just to see if you are simple-minded, basically. You know, and are looking for an easy way to dismiss it. Well, whoever wrote this doesn't even know what the hell the word meteorite means. You know, and, you know, that's a rock that's sitting on the ground. This is garbage. Forget about this book. Right? Yeah. You know, are you one of those people? Or are you someone, no, you know, I'm pretty sure this is not just written by Bob and it's just a bunch of drivel. Why did they use that? Well, I don't know. What does meteor mean? Let me look that up. And, oh, wait, meteorology is right next to the word meteorite in the dictionary. Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, why do we call it meteorology, you know? That doesn't have anything to do with flaming rocks. They want you to reflect. Yeah.
Well, bring up what you're saying. So we're in the very beginning stages of this revelation. And then 500,000 years from now, people hopefully will be a whole lot smarter and wiser and they'll go through it. And these are the kinds of things that are going to keep them engaged, so to speak, in my opinion, that, you know, very few people are picking up on, even who are... been long-time readers of the Revelation. Be quite frankly, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to this particular section.
Right.
To me, it's not as important right now in my particular.
Not as immediate in your life, yes.
But if the rest of it became more important, and we were all loving you know, living like the way we should be, the rest of this is going to become more meaningful to people in the future, in my opinion.
Definitely so. And then just, you know, think about that all that verbiage I just spewed out there about the word meteorite. Notice fundamentally what I was trying to get at there. This is not a scientific text any more than it's a religious text. If they use the word meteorite, don't think first of it being a scientific term. Thinking of it as being a philosophic term. Seek first a philosophic relationship to the words, not a scientific or a religious relationship to the words. And that's why I had to go into that as much as I did. I was trying to get you to think philosophically about the word meteorite, not scientifically, not going to the dictionary, and which is, the only thing that's in the dictionary is what the scientists have dictated is going to be in there. You know, any more than you can figure out what the word power in the Urantia book means by going to the dictionary and look at what the dictionary author put in there because of what the scientists told him to put them in there for the word power. Right? You know, you got to think of it as a philosophic word, not a scientific word. You got to think of the word spirit as a philosophic word, not a religious word. You got to think of the word God as a philosophic word, not so much a religious word. You know, and the word deity is directly a philosophic word and not a religious word. And when you define God to be personalized deity, see what you just did to the word God? You made it more fundamentally a philosophic word, not a religious word. If it's a religious word, it doesn't have a definition. There isn't something more fundamental than God. God is an initial assumption and is a giant mystery, an infinite mystery. No, if it's a philosophic word, there's stuff more fundamental, and you can derive God from more first-like principles, more primary principles. Yeah. So you got to recognize that. Here we're just happen to be in a scientific, set of passages. It's the same is true in what you think is a religious set of passages. You know, if you treat those words there like a scientist is going to treat this word meteorite, you're going to go off on false tangents the same way the scientist will when he sees that word. Okay. All right, so let's see. Things are starting to get a little bit, riled up. We had this, it was all nice and stable. All the space was cleaned. Think about this as just like something you do in your life. You get, your yard all organized, and then the wind comes up and just makes a total mess out of it. Okay. As below, so above. Right? That matter of fact, that's why it does it below, is because it does it above, right? I mean, we don't live in Havona, okay? In the macroscopic or the microscopic, right? And nothing is eternal yet. Everything is going to be completely, set asunder and upended. And okay, so all of this, it seemed like this beautiful, idyllic place was setting in, and then along comes this giant rock in the pond, and just totally messes it up. There's a truth there. Like I say, there's a general truth there. If you're in a philosophic mode, this reminds me of a truth about my life. Or the world I'm on, or whatnot, yeah.
Talk about it.
You have to be open to change, right? No matter how grand it might seem, it's like, well, God is definitely going to be completely in charge of something the size of a star and all of the space around it, and if he's obviously setting it in for the long haul, nothing can put it asunder. No. Again, God didn't join the gas molecules of the sun together because Angana just put them asunder. It's just like the marriage thing, right? God had actually joined those two people together. They never could come apart. This is not that God didn't assemble those atoms to make that star directly. Right? There's a lot of lessons here. Once you see it philosophically, you're seeing it holistically. We could just go on for hours about all the things that this is relevant to. Right? So it doesn't appear that this is relevant to your immediate life, but it is. It's teaching you lessons about your life if you're approaching it philosophically and not scientifically. All right, let's get some more.
As the Angana system drew near, the solar extrusions grew larger and larger, More and more matter was drawn from the sun to become independent circulating bodies in surrounding space. This situation developed for about 500,000 years until Angana made its closest approach to the sun, whereupon the sun, in conjunction with one of its periodic internal convulsions, experienced a partial disruption. From opposite sides and simultaneously, enormous volumes of matter were disgorged. From the Angana side, there was drawn out a vast column of solar gases, rather pointed at both ends and markedly bulging at the center, which became permanently detached from the immediate gravity control of the sun.
Okay.
Just like you said a second ago, it sort of sounds like the nebula coming out.
Right, so you know, you're definitely going to see things that are similar. Only now it is very directly a tidal thing. I'll speak to that in a second. Let me just bring up this other point before I forget. So they're giving you the time scale of this. There's about 500,000 years where it's close enough to start having some impact to its closest point. Yeah. So just, you know, think about the sphere of the sun, and you've got this object just going on a straight line past it. Right? And there's some point when it's at closest approach, you know, as it's going by, and then it's going to head off. And it's going to be another 500,000 years on the other side where it gets farther and farther until finally, you know, it's so far away it's not even having a tiny, you know, influence. So you got 1,000,000 years. You know, of a collision, not a direct collision, you know, but, you know, you call this, you know, in scientific terms, you call that a collision, right? And there's that point of closest approach as it's going by, but the whole thing is a collision phenomenon because the two objects are interacting with one another. The Angana system is going to have a lot more impact on the sun than vice versa because there's this huge mass difference. Right? So the sun is, you know, like they're saying there, just about gets literally ripped to pieces. I mean, if it had passed a little bit closer, it would have just destroyed the sun. You know, it would have spewed it all over the place and everything would have just started all over again.
Messy.
Okay.
So they could calculate. I mean, they could be moving the Angana system a little bit so that it passes with the perfect distance.
Okay, so let's think about that. You know, is it possible that there was some tweaking that went on to the Angana system? Doesn't have to be. I mean, they don't have to have this place be an inhabited solar system. You know, any more than they did things to prevent, you know, certain supernovas from going off. And, you know, that doesn't just blow up that star and any planets that were around it. But, I mean, any nearby stars and planets are just, you know, going to be, you know, not going to be inhabited, you know, inhabitable.
If you look at it the other way, the sun's effect on the Angana, you know, there could have been planet and light and life and that they may have. You know, wanted to somehow keep it from getting too
screwed up. Right. See, obviously, you can just speculate. But remember that, you know, you're at a very early stage here. So your first thought would tend to be they're still in a mode where they're kind of just letting things do a lot of their, you know, a lot of what they want to do naturally. And when things settle out, you know, later on, then they'll start focusing in even more. It's like, okay, I want to use this spot. Again, it's, you know, they
said Angana might be pretty old.
Yeah, Angana is going to be super, so you know. So long, you know, I mean, long before they, you know, that whole story we were reading, you know, and bringing the Andromeda Nebula into the Milky Way galaxy, you know, they know they're bringing it in to where this Angana system is going to impact some of it. Right? It's not going to just, you know, Angana obviously didn't just impact our sun, it would have impacted many, you know, and still is. It's still impacting things, right? I mean, eventually they're going to have to get it, you know, they can't have it marauding through Nebadon, ripping, you know, things apart. So, yeah, they're going to have to bring it into control more and more and more. right? But, you know, certainly in this part of Nebadon, as like we're reading, things are in a pretty, you know, rough state, you know, with a lot of the stars that came from the Andromeda Nebula. So they could probably just let things take its natural course quite a bit, you know, and then they'll figure out what's what's left in the wake of it all.
It just doesn't sound like there was too much, like, if you look at the trajectory angle of the Andromeda system, that, you know, a little closer would have not worked.
Yeah.
A little farther.
Nothing would have happened. There wouldn't have been a solar system. You know?
And the stuff that came out, you know, one of the planets just happens to be the right distance from the sun.
But then, of course, like we said, you also have a whole bunch of planets like Jupiter. Yeah. What's the point of Jupiter? Like we said, I mean, eventually, you know, in the central universe, you don't have Jupiters just, you know, laying around, you know, I mean, for no reason. So as much as it made something significant, it made a lot more stuff that apparently isn't part of eternity at all. And the thing that really points this out, even though, even though Mon Mash is in the title of the section, remember, it's not given that name until 3 billion years ago. Right. See, so they didn't really zoom in and say, okay, yeah, this is a place that we can make an inhabited system. Until all this was, you know, way in the rearview mirror. And see, so that does speak to the fact that probably they were just letting it do whatever. You know, we saw lots and lots of gorgeous stars got totally, you know, gobbled up and torn apart and were lost in all those things that happened with the formation, you know, of the stars of Andromeda. You know, remember that, you know, they talk about even those, the last disgorgement, you know, messed up a whole bunch of stars that had formed prior to that. So, yeah. Okay, so things are, you know, most likely it's just they're just sitting back watching what's happening, and they'll see if there's anything left in the wake that you can work with. All right, let's see. Now, where were we? Okay, so yeah, so back to this paragraph. Let's see, what else do we have there? Oh, yeah, the whole bit about the opposite sides, right? So you finally got to the point, like we knew was coming, where it's gonna really pull off a big, gigantic blob of the sun. But it has this on both sides. Now, it's not that bipolar ejection phenomenon we saw before. This is literally just a tidal thing, you know, like the tides you have on the Earth right now from the moon. Right, you have a high tide on each side of the Earth, you know, and the line connecting the centers of the moon and the Earth, right? Because the water that's closest to the moon gets pulled towards the moon more than the center of the Earth, so the water bulges up relatively, and the center of the Earth gets pulled towards the moon more than the water that's on the far side of the Earth, and so the water, you know, gets relatively bulged up there too. You know, because, you know, the gravitational force is not constant with distance. It falls off as 1/r². Right? So the gravity on the far side of the Earth on that water is much less, you know, being pulled towards the moon, much less than the center of the Earth is being pulled. And so the distance between that water and the center of the Earth increases. That water bulges up on the opposite side. Right? You've got the same thing here, only on a huge scale. Right? Angana is pulling the outer part of the sun that's closest to it, you know, very definitively more than it is the center of the sun, but it's also pulling the center of the sun a lot harder than it is the gas on the opposite side of the sun, and so that bulges out too, to the point where some of it, you know, is disgorged as well. Not as much, you know, the high tide on the opposite side of the Earth is slower than the high tide on the, you know, side of the Earth closer to the moon. Right, so you just have a massive tidal disruption of the sun because gravity is not constant with distance.
Okay. Taking what's already there and exacerbating it.
Right, right, and it's just, you know, that you get it when it's on one of its expansion, you know, phases of its oscillation cycle. So it's already, you know, less held less tightly, right. And you rip it off. All right, so...
Is 3.5 days still which means over a million years, this thing's
through
a whole bunch of these.
Yeah, good point. Why don't we just bring that up right here? I mean, we kind of just blew through it, but remember, they were talking about the solar meteorites and stuff. I mean, by the time you actually get this big column of matter drawn off, you not only have that and the stuff on the other side, but you've got all kinds of stuff littering space already. It's been pulling small stuff. See, so this beautiful cleared space is now just debris as far as the eye can see in every direction. And that's why we know as you start moving way out past the planets, we know there's all kinds of debris out there. I mean, even when you're still in the midst of the outer planets, we've discovered there's all kinds of smaller objects out there, thousands and thousands of objects, because this is a very messy process. Over a million years' time, spewing stuff all over the place. And obviously, over a million years' time, some of the stuff that got pulled just a little ways off the sun is going to be, dragged, or whichever word, by Angana, way off, before Angana gets too far away. And, so it goes into these orbits way out there in the hinterlands. All right, so you've got this big mess of stuff. But over time, it's going to start to clear up again. Things will consolidate. Things are relatively clear again with just the planets, going around the sun. But in this initial state, it's a big mess. There's stuff of many different generations of disgorgements before and after the big disgorgement.
Relative to a million years, that's 3 days and a half day cycle. Yeah. It's like buzzing.
Right. Right.
It's crackling.
Right. And so it's just sputtering, it's just sputtering stuff off for a million years all over the place.
Calculate the frequency. If you slowed it all the hearing range, it'd sound like you could make a sound out of it.
Yeah, you could. You could just scale it, Okay, so so we've gotten to the maximum of messing up this beautiful thing that had formed, and now we're going to start to go the other direction and see if we can start cleaning it up again. Okay, what do they say here next?
This great column of solar gases, which was thus separated from the sun, subsequently evolved into the 12 planets of the solar system. The repercussional ejection of gas from the opposite side of the sun in tidal sympathy with the extrusion of this gigantic solar system ancestor has since condensed into the meteors and space dust of the solar system. Although much, very much, of this matter was subsequently recaptured by solar gravity as the Angana system receded into remote space.
Right, so because this is 4.5 billion years ago, in a genuine sense, there's a long time for things to clean back up again. And, mostly, the stuff, the meteors and stuff that rain in on the Earth now are not from this, as they're pointing out. Very much of that is this stuff got recaptured. We've had a lot of other events that we'll read about here in a little bit, like the fifth planet getting ripped apart, making the asteroids. And like I said, they call them asteroids and meteoroids. In other words, small things that are too small to be called asteroids, debris from that disruption. And so a lot of the debris is more recent than, this debris-generating event. Is what I'm trying to get at.
Like you said, secondary, tertiary.
Right. So, however, if you go way out in the solar system, maybe some of that stuff that's way out there actually is condensation from this. It was far enough out that it didn't get pulled back into the sun eventually. Garnered up by the planets themselves too, especially Jupiter, pulled a lot of stuff, into it, that was hanging around.
What are we going to do if we have an object land on the planet that we do a date on and it's
it's older than the age of the universe? That actually would be a handy thing to happen, right? Might bring some humility into scientific endeavor. Anyway.
Please, God, give us a space rock that we can date.
Oh, maybe I should just mention on that. The thing about the dating, those are, the radiometric dating is dating a crystallization age. I mean, you're, you know, you have a, you know, like say a magma, you know, that crystallizes. And so the atoms in that rock are locked into it. You know, no new atoms can get in. You know, no atoms can get out. And it's because things are locked in at that point that you can start a radiometric clock and see, well, you know, as these radioactive elements decay, how many of the parents do I have relative to daughters? You know, the more daughter atoms I have, obviously, the longer it's been decaying, and you're assuming that those daughter atoms haven't escaped, right? So that there's fewer than, you know, or new ones haven't somehow gotten in, right? You have a lot of assumptions, but you know, you're not dating an atom. You know, you're just dating when that rock crystallized. And that's the other thing that's really kind of fuzzy. They'll use these radiometric dates like it's how old the solar nebula is or something. It's like, no, that's how old that rock is when it crystallized. It doesn't tell you how old the solar nebula is, even though there wasn't a solar nebula. Right, so it all gets a little bit, unfortunately, imprecise. But anyway, back to the story here. You know, when they say meteors and space dust in there, they don't go into it a lot of detail here. But, you know, you're starting out, you just have gas, obviously, you know, that you're pulling off the sun. But eventually things are going to cool and condense, you know, and you're going to start to get solid stuff, you know, instead of gaseous matter. You know, cooling and condensation can be happening on very small scales. It isn't all just cooling and condensing into great big objects, you know, doing that all sorts of different sizes. Okay, so let's see. What else do we have there? I think we got it all there. Yeah, we got all that. Okay, so let's keep going here.
Although Angana succeeded in drawing away the ancestral material of the solar system, planets, and the enormous volume of matter now circulating about the sun as asteroids and meteors, it did not secure for itself any of this solar matter. The visiting system did not come quite close enough to actually steal any of the sun's substance, but it did swing sufficiently close to draw off into the intervening space, all of the material comprising the present-day solar system.
It's giving you little hints like that. See, so it that gives you, you know, especially when they talk about, you know, some stuff here in a little bit about, you know, the planets that were orbiting around that dark island of space. You can tell this is a vast planetary system it had around it. Not only did it not draw close enough to where it stole away any matter permanently from this immediate region around the sun. But it's not like hundreds of planets going around the dark island were slamming into our sun and, you know, in this column of gas and stuff.
Yeah. Right. It had to be far enough away too.
It was right. So it was, you know, it was quite a ways away. You know, you can imagine some of those planets were orbiting way, way, way far away from such a giant mass. And so but you know, it was still even farther away than that, you know, yeah, that any of those things came slamming into all this. You know, with one little asterisk, as we know, they'll tell us in a little bit. But you know, so it's you know, it's just close enough that you can have this major event of getting some matter out there for a solar system, but not so close that it did some really serious disrupting of that event or itself. You know, it left the scene pretty much unscathed from this whole phenomenon. You know, not really significantly added to or subtracted from. Okay, let's see. You know, we should mention, I forgot, they did already say that in that previous paragraph. Remember, they said 12 planets, quote-unquote. And that one should, you know, catch everyone's attention. What are those 12 planets? Well, Mercury is one, Venus is two, our planet is three, Mars is four, and like I said, they'll tell us about it in a minute. The fifth one got ripped apart, you know, and that's the asteroid belt. But there's the big spherical, big, you know, the biggest glob of debris that is big enough to form back into a sphere, Ceres, you know, which is considered now a dwarf planet, but it's actually the core of that fifth planet, Ceres. So you can call Ceres the fifth planet. Mm-hmm. Jupiter's the sixth. Saturn's the seventh. Uranus is the eighth. Neptune is the ninth. Pluto is the tenth.
Even though
now it's called a dwarf planet. Okay, we'll talk about Pluto in a little bit of details of it, why it is what it is right now. But see, that's 10. You got two more, right? Pretty sure that the 12th planet is Eris, one of those objects we found in more recent years that's out there. It's one of the big ones. It's not super huge because it's going to be the 12th. It's going to, you know, you'd expect it to be kind of like Mercury. Right, it's a, you know, they said there's this big tapering column, right? So way out on that far end, they're going to be small, like they are on the.
What's that belt way out
the end
called?
The Kuiper Belt, right? Now, so beyond the Kuiper Belt, there's Eris, and that's most likely the 12th. We're missing the 11th planet. Right? Yeah, you know, we talked about that. That's most likely the non-breather world. Right, that's you know, when they tell you you're 12, and you know, and we know quite a bit about what's out there now, and we're obviously missing one, you know, and there ought to be one right there on the outside of that Kuiper Belt that's shepherding that into the Kuiper Cliff, you know, relatively outer clean edge of that belt of stuff. And so,
did we draw any planets from Angola?
Yeah, we're gonna get that. Okay, that's so coming up in just a second. Yep.
So they didn't steal any, but that's me.
You brought this up,
man. So if the non-breather plant is out there, it could have been in the Angona thing when it came through and been pulled off.
Well, I'll explain. You'll see what they tell us.
There, we can't see. Is it possible that they're hiding it on purpose?
Well, again, you know, like we talked about, I mean, okay, all they have to do is just not let sunlight reflect off it, and right, we wouldn't know it there visually, but there's this obvious gravitational thing going on out there.
Kuiper Cliff isn't natural.
It's just like, remember, how do they know where the dark islands? How do the celestial astronomers know, you know, about where the dark islands are and stuff? I mean, they can't see them. They're not right, but they can see the gravitational impact.
Yeah, see.
See, it's the same thing. Yeah, you can effectively see them by their gravitational influence, even though you can't see them because there's photons coming from them.
You couldn't have seen Angona either.
I mean, again, you couldn't see Angona because, right. I mean, if the moon didn't reflect sunlight, you couldn't see it. At new moon, you don't see the moon. You know, you wouldn't know the moon is there unless you put two and two together. It's like, well, what's making these tides?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And obviously, you know, we see it gravitationally, even if you couldn't see it visually because sunlight was reflecting off of it. Yeah. So, and then every once in a while, whoa, something is blocking the sun.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You still don't see the moon when it's blocking the sun, but you know, right? You know there's something there. Right. So, yeah, that's you know. So anyway, the 12, it's all very suspicious now that the 11th is the non-breather world. Because the distance between Pluto, the 10th, and Eris, the 12th, is like just suspiciously a large distance. It's like there ought to be another one in there. Yeah. And, right where it ought to be is right on the outside of the Kuiper Cliff. Yeah. Okay, meanwhile, back to the story. So, okay, so we've got all this drawn off. Let's make sure we didn't. What else we have there? Right, the Angona system didn't take anything away. What else did they say there? Yeah, okay, so just maybe just one little thought, that intervening space thing at the end of that paragraph. Remember, we were just talking about it is quite a long ways away. So intervening space is a big space. So again, we shouldn't be surprised that the more we study the outer reaches of the solar system, there's stuff out there, right? Intervening is going to be a lot farther than out to Eris.
Yeah.
Okay, intervening is going to be way, way, way out. There's likely a big cloud of stuff out there. You know, there is the idea of the Oort cloud of stuff. You know, current scientists think that's out there because that's the stuff that didn't all collapse in. But there's likely a whole bunch of stuff out there because that's the stuff that got drawn out way far away from the sun.
It's all still orbiting our sun.
And it's all still orbiting the sun.
So there's gravitation.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. See, all of it, even the tiny little bits, didn't get drug away. So if there was parts of the sun that got pulled way far out there, they're way far out there going around and around the sun in very long orbits. Yeah, big cloud of stuff. And we've started to find some of the larger clods, you know, that are on very vast remote orbits. Okay.
We will bring one back.
Yeah. There are undoubtedly could be some interesting radiometric dates on some of that stuff.
I told you not to date those.
Don't ask questions that you don't want to get the answers to. Let's see. Okay, so yeah, so just to stress that Angana has made a big mess of a big region of space. All right, let's keep going.
The five inner and five outer planets soon formed in miniature from the cooling and condensing nucleuses in the less massive and tapering ends of the gigantic gravity bulge, which Angana had succeeded in detaching from the sun. While Saturn and Jupiter were formed from the more massive and bulging central portions. The powerful gravity pull of Jupiter and Saturn early captured most of the material stolen from Angana, as the retrograde motion of certain of their satellites bears witness.
Okay, so...
theft.
Now, we haven't gotten to the biggie thing about what we stole from Angana, but we stole lots of little stuff. See, so again... you know, way in the outer reaches of that Angana system is going to be all kinds of little stuff, you know, orbiting about it. And all that did get grabbed. And when you look at, you know, especially Jupiter, but Saturn too, as a lot of them, there's all kinds of big rocks, that are moons of Jupiter and Saturn, you know, outside of the bigger moons, you know, closer in. Mm-hmm. Dozens and dozens of these things. And they're all, Jupiter, all the outer ones, and most of the outer ones in Saturn are in retrograde orbits. You know, Jupiter, you know, like if I curl my hand in the way, my fingers in the way Jupiter's rotating, my thumb is up, and let's call that prograde. Yeah. You know, the moons are not going in that right-hand way around, you know, they're going, you know, the opposite way. They're in retrograde. So obviously they're not part of the, you know, all that gas, all that stuff that was pulled off the sun is all going to be going the same direction around. Right? If there's anything that's going the opposite direction in the solar system, that has to be stuff we captured from the Angana system. So all those big rocks that are going around Jupiter.
Why would it be going in the opposite direction?
It doesn't have to be. Some of the stuff we captured is going in the same direction. They'll mention that at the end of the section, the question you just asked. But if there's something going in retrograde, it had to have come from an external source.
The retrograde, in this case, means that the actual sphere itself is turning, like our planet turns, you know?
No, this retrograde we're talking about, forget about what the little rock is doing as a moon in terms of its rotation.
Okay.
Its orbit about Jupiter is in the opposite direction of all of the moons that formed as part of the solar material that was pulled out.
Okay.
You know, they've just been captured in an orbit in the opposite direction. You know, see, if some foreign object is approaching Jupiter, if it doesn't just fall right into it,
okay,
if it goes into orbit, it's going to go around in orbit around one way or the other way. depending on which side it hits. You know, if it comes in on this side, it goes around this way. If it comes in on the other side, it goes around that way.
It has nothing to do with Jupiter's rotation.
No. It just has to do with that object, you know, how it impacted Jupiter and went into orbit. So obviously anything that went into a retrograde orbit couldn't have been part of the initial swirling phenomenon. It's a foreign object that's been thrown in. Some of the things that are prograde are also foreign objects. Yeah. But, you know, you'd have to carefully go in and study them and figure out which is which. But the ones that are going retrograde, you don't have to be close at all. We can tell from here, that's all stuff that was captured for the Angana system. All those objects that are going around in the wrong direction.
Yeah, those can't happen from within here. They had to come in from outside.
Yeah, yeah. Any retrograde motion indicates a foreign object has been injected into the system because there's conservation of angular momentum. Everything is going in the same direction internally.
Jupiter, as it's turning, doesn't its gravitational sort of slow that down going the other way eventually?
Again, you know, they're not dragging through the atmosphere.
Okay, true.
So
what you're saying is there are some satellites around Jupiter going one way and some are going the other way.
Right. Yeah? Yeah. I think there's I think we found 67 moons around Jupiter, I think it is. See, and most of those are these big rocks.
Okay.
See? And they're big rocks. You know, they're like asteroid-sized things, you know. And, you know, maybe they're a kilometer, you know, in diameter or something like that. Okay. So they're city-sized rocks. But you've got all these ones that are going in retrograde. Okay, around Jupiter. That's what they're referring to. So, but, you know, a lot of that stuff would have been swallowed up by Jupiter or swallowed up by the sun. But some of it is still orbiting as moonlets, you know. And you can see that. Okay. Obviously, a lot of the rocky core of, say, Jupiter, you know, would have come from captured objects.
Even though it's gaseous?
Even though it's mostly gaseous. But, you know, just thinking about it, it's got there's heavier elements down in the core, see, you know, that would have come from capturing a whole bunch of stuff that was out and about in the Angana system. So you've got that. Let's go to the next thing here and get a little bit more.
Jupiter and Saturn, being derived from the very center of the enormous column of superheated solar gases, contained so much highly heated sun material that they shone with a brilliant light and emitted enormous volumes of heat. They were in reality secondary suns for a short period after their formation as separate space bodies. These two largest of the solar system planets have remained largely gaseous to this day, not even yet having cooled off to the point of complete condensation or solidification.
Okay, so you know, see, if Angana had pulled off a little bit more stuff, we really, you know, we came really close to being left with a binary or a trinary star system.
Right.
Okay. and like they're saying, well, technically, for a little while there was, you know, when that central part condensed, you actually had the thing functioning as a star for a little while, but, you know, it didn't last long and it cooled off too much and it got below the electronic boiling point, you know, temperature in the center. But it was a big enough blob that for a little while, and it's still, Jupiter still gives off, you know, more heat than it receives from the sun. I mean, it's got a lot of heat that it's still giving off. And like you're saying, you know, just as it condenses, it heats up. As it contracts, it heats up. Yeah.
Still got a lot of masses.
Yeah.
It'll take a long time for that
right.
to settle out.
So you're about to see at the beginning of the next paragraph there. On the one thing that happens, you may remember this back when we read about all this stuff in general in those earlier papers. One of the things that's happening is "quote unquote" gas contraction. You just have this gas in a relatively low density state, and it's just starting to contract. And to a large degree, Jupiter and Saturn are just gas contraction spheres. You know, basically what you have there is still just a ball of gas. Once things get cooled enough and solidified, then you have the process of matter accreting to that solid nucleus. So besides gas contraction, you have accretion. You know, and we all know when you look at a lot of the planets in the solar system, they're covered with, you know, impacts. You know, and that was just the last stuff that was raining down. I mean, the whole thing was basically built up by stuff raining down on a solidified nucleus, right? You know, with the five on the inside and the five on the outside, you know, they had a lot of that just accretion of material. But Jupiter and Saturn, you know, are to a large degree just a contraction of a blob of gas into a big sphere. Okay, and that can happen pretty fast. Right? You can just take a big blob of gas and you let gravity work for a little while, and you know it contracts into a sphere. But it takes a lot longer for things to finally. I mean, you know, they still haven't completely condensed, you know, or solidified. It takes a lot longer, even if it's smaller like the Earth, for things to you know, to get to the point where it you know, it actually solidifies, and then you slowly build it up by stuff raining in on it. That takes a long time. But the current model of the formation of the solar system, they think it happens really fast because they think everything is just gas that goes, you know, by gravity, and in 5 seconds it's all collected together into little balls, you know, and there's rocks on the surface. It's like, no, you have a ball of gas, but you don't have a solid object, you know. So that's, you know, the main reason how they convince themselves that the solar system formed really fast like it has to now, because they've got rocks that they think are basically as old as the sun, you know, that are on the surface of the Earth, and they have, so they've got to make the thing all happen, you know, in a split second, in geologic terms. So that's in, that's, you know, but here you see shades of that. In the case of Jupiter and Saturn, you're going to have really big balls of gas in a relatively short span of time before you've got much to talk about with the other 10 planets. Okay. You know, like I said, I mean, they got together dense enough that they actually were functioning like a little star for a little while. I mean, you know that we've already left that part of the story behind. That happened so fast.
Yeah. So are the rings around Saturn gas or are they rock?
That's dust. And we'll get to that. That's coming up in the next, I guess that's the next section. But that's right. Yeah. That's basically dust. Let's see. Okay. Anything else we had to see? Make sure we don't skip things here. I think I got everything, didn't I? Let's see. I think it's going to the next paragraph here.
The gas contraction nucleuses of the other 10 planets soon reached the stage of solidification and so began to draw to themselves increasing quantities of the meteoric matter circulating in nearby space. The worlds of the solar system thus had a double origin, nucleuses of gas condensation later on augmented by the capture of enormous quantities of meteors. Indeed, they still continue to capture meteors, but in greatly lessened numbers.
See, so like I said, then that second is accretion. Like I said, Jupiter and Saturn are, you know, a large degree of just gas contraction and some accretion. But the other ones, you know, the gas contraction nucleus was just a small, relatively small, like the Earth's initial, you know, that gas contraction nucleus was a very small object in relative terms. Most of the Earth was built up, you know, by accreting stuff onto that nucleus, you know, rather than something that was basically as much matter as the Earth, just, you know, contracting and solidifying.
Yeah. But all coming from...
All coming from all this stuff that was pulled out of the sun. Yeah. It's just that some of the stuff that was pulled off and was debris, you know, cools and condenses and then, you know, lands on the Earth, you know. So it isn't, you know, definitely in the, you know, the current way they think, an awful lot of the Earth was just stuff that was sort of right there and just collected together. You know, like I said, they basically think you get something the diameter of the Earth by just condensing what's immediately in that region, as opposed to what's immediately in that region, just making a relatively small sphere, and then all of the debris, you know, building it up to a bigger object.
In this less than 1% formation stuff. In another way, yeah. What they're thinking would yeah. be... Like,
in some, yeah, for some solar systems. Right. Yeah, right, yeah. It's just, see, and again, they can tell us all this because obviously we can't figure it out. We're way off track on it, you know, so they're trying to, you know, give us what actually happened so we aren't spending endless, you know, centuries off on a false tangent about trying to understand the solar system. Okay, let's see. What else do we have there? You notice a meteoric matter, you know, especially when you get farther in the story, I mean, now start to think of, you know, rocks, you know, giant boulders and whatnot, as opposed to the blobs of gas like those solar meteorites they were talking about. At this point, you're starting to think more of that, you know, what you think of when you think
there's no atmosphere.
So it just keeps. Of course not. Right? It's just a bare ball of rock, you know, molten rock that stuff is raining in on. Yeah. Let's see.
Good thing, because things can rain in without an atmosphere. You can build up a surface. If you had an atmosphere, it would all get burned.
All get vaporized, and yeah. Yeah.
So is the Earth, at that time, this teeny Earth, is it the gravity in the Earth that's pulling those?
Yep, things? Yep. Yeah, the gravity of the Earth is just pulling in all the stuff. I mean, obviously, occasionally you'll randomly have something just on a tear and slams right into it, but mostly it's just gravitationally drawing in all the matter around it. Let's see here. Let me see, the dual origin. Yeah, okay. Oh, and just continue to capture meteors. I mean, everyone knows you can see meteors and meteor showers and stuff. But don't forget there's an awful lot that you don't see. You know, meteors aren't just those bright flashes you see in the sky occasionally. There's all kinds of tiny stuff that's constantly raining in. I mean, you know, some of the dust, you know, it builds up on things. It's just the endless rain of dust from from space settling down on the Earth. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, you know, it burns up a lot of that, you know, ends up as stuff in the atmosphere that, you know, settles down too. But
is that why you have to excavate historic sites, because the dust is...
Well, I mean, obviously there's a lot of, you know, I mean, but some of the dust is not just stuff on the Earth blowing around. I mean, just recognize there's just an endless rain of material coming in on the Earth all the time. I mean, the sun, you know, is constantly capturing just, you know, megatons of matter, you know, and just tons of stuff is raining in on the sun all the time. Let's see here. Let's go to the next paragraph.
The planets do not swing around the sun in the equatorial plane of their solar mother, which they would do if they had been thrown off by solar revolution. Rather, they travel in the plane of the Angana solar extrusion, which existed at a considerable angle to the plane of the sun's equator.
Okay, so now that's the big point that is glaringly ignored in the current rationalization scheme. So either way, there's the thought they have right there, you know, you imagine that somehow you have a central object and it flings off material. Okay, that's obviously going to be flung off in the plane of the rotation of that object, and so that material would fan out in the equatorial plane of that central object. Same way, if it's all just a cloud that's condensing in, you know, the disk of matter that's going to build up around that collapsing gas is going to be in the equatorial plane of the central object, right? Because it's all just one angular momentum system. Right. The glaring thing, you know, I mean, take the Earth's orbit as a simple example. The Earth's orbit is tilted, the plane of the Earth's orbit is tilted more than 7 degrees relative to the plane of the sun's equator. the ecliptic, as they call it, that plane of the Earth's orbit, and basically the orbits of the other planets, right, is tipped many degrees from the sun's equatorial plane. That's, if the solar system formed like they say it did, that wouldn't be the case. Everything would be basically in the plane of this.
So how does science explain that one?
They just ignore that fact. That is just conveniently never discussed. I mean, you can look up all these angles and everything, to several significant, digits, but.
Right. I gotcha.
Right. So what happened is you had the sun, if the sun's equatorial plane is horizontal in front of you here, and Ghana is not coming in, in that plane, it's coming in, at an angle. And so it's pulling a tongue off at an angle of, above and below that plane. Okay.
So inconvenient. Okay. So are the...
just one more thing before I forget. The, like Mercury and Venus, they are slowly getting, over billions of years, their orbital planes are getting closer and closer to the plane of the sun's equator. They're not as tilted off as the Earth is, say. But they're still, several degrees off of the sun's equatorial plane. Obviously, not something that is, there's obviously a foreign influence that produced that angle. There's nothing internal in the sun or anything that might do, that's at several degrees from its equatorial plane in terms of symmetry. So
there's ones in the normal orbit and there's ones in the retrograde orbit.
Yeah.
They're all in a plane?
I mean, obviously, the farther you get out, the messier it gets. I mean, the close-in ones are basically all in the, but you start to get stuff that are, it's just like with the solar system. As you get out to those farther things, you start to have objects that are going at all sorts of, wild orbits, high angles and stuff, because they have all sorts of chaos has led to them. And
That's one thing. Just curious. I mean, does a body in general tend to pull things down into the plane as they, orbit?
Well, I mean, you see, you're going to have, a long-term tidal effect, like John was alluding to there, the sun isn't a perfect sphere. It's a little flattened. See, so the gravitational influence, is not perfectly spherical.
Tends to shepherd them.
Right. It's going to tend to, over time, slowly get pulled, but it's going to have to be pretty close. I mean, you go out farther to Jupiter, and, Jupiter doesn't care the difference between the spherical and a slightly not spherical sun. It's just a point, that it's orbiting about. But close in, you start to have, gravitational aspects of the gravitational field that aren't just purely spherically symmetric.
So you could also look at all the moons of, say, Jupiter, and compare the different angles that they're. This stuff couldn't have really come in from this angle.
You've got all kinds of information like that, yeah. let's see. This should work perfectly. 15 minutes, a couple more paragraphs here. Okay. Let's see. So, anything else there? I guess we got all that. But that's the real biggie. And then they're going to comment on those issues a little bit more here. The issue of retrograde and, the basic aspects that are sort of first-order facts about the solar system that are just screaming at everyone, ever since we first started thinking about the solar system, that there's some sort of, it's not just something the sun and the local stuff did. There's an otherness to this solar system that is glaringly obvious. Okay. All right.
While Angana was unable to capture any of the solar mass, your sun did add to its metamorphosing planetary family some of the circulating space material of the visiting system. Mm-hmm. Due to the intense gravity field of Angana, its tributary planetary family pursued orbits of considerable distance from the dark giant. And shortly after the extrusion of the solar system ancestral mass, and while Angana was yet in the vicinity of the sun, three of the major planets of the Angana system swung so near to the massive solar system ancestor that its gravitational pull, augmented by that of the sun, was sufficient to overbalance the gravity grasp of Angana and to permanently detach these three tributaries of the celestial wanderer.
Okay, so besides lots of small stuff, you know, basically debris that we captured, we did capture three significant objects, you know, planets of the Angana system. So what that means is there should be three major retrograde facts to the solar system. Lots of minor retrograde facts, but there should be three glaring holes, you know, three glaring retrograde facts in the solar system.
And by retrograde in this instance, they're not necessarily going around the sun in a different way.
Any sort of retrograde, something that's not, I mean, again, you know, the rotation of the Earth, you know, is prograde with its orbit. I mean, there should be three things that break that natural internal symmetry, three others, you know, three distinct elements of otherness, three giant rocks dropped in the pond of the solar system that you should be able to pick out. So let's start at the center. So you look at Mercury. No, everything seems to be as you would expect there. Venus. No, is an issue. Okay. Venus rotates, you know, it goes around the sun prograde, but it rotates retrograde. It's not rotating like this with my right thumb up, it's rotating with my right thumb down. Okay? So what happened there? Well, the other thing you notice, Venus is curiously bigger than you'd expect it to be. Being, you know, it should be more intermediate between Mercury and the Earth. Instead, it's almost as big as the Earth. You know, really close to being as big as the Earth. Okay, obviously what happened? One of those three objects slammed into Venus. It captured that, made it bigger. Plus, you know, it was rotating along just, you know, delightfully. And this object slammed into it, brought it almost to a dead stop in terms of rotating. It rotates retrograde really, really slowly. I think, what is it, 243 days for one Venusian day? Something like that?
It slammed into it.
See, so it slammed.
That close then to our sun.
Right. These three objects, you know, were pulled in. And so, you know, they,
just way out.
You know, and they're coming in, you know, and they're eventually getting, you know, slamming into something in the solar system. Not immediately, necessarily, but eventually, you know, there was obviously a Venus that got, got hit by one of these and, you know, accreted that one of those three objects. And it completely disrupted the internal dynamics of it. You know, Venus has a very bizarre internal thermal nature and stuff. Again, we don't need to go into all that. But there's a whole bunch of things about Venus that just scream, okay, one of those objects ended up there. One of those three objects ended up there. That's a hole in the beautiful symmetric picture. Earth, okay, fine. Mars, yeah, fine. Ceres and the asteroid belt, you know, basically fine. Yes, it got ripped apart. But Jupiter, okay, fine. Saturn, fine. Oops, Uranus.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Uranus got, obviously, captured one of the objects, too. It got objects slammed into it and knocked Uranus over on its side. You know, it's almost 90, you know, it's actually a little bit further. It tipped it more, a little bit more than 90 degrees, you know, out of the plane of, you know, relative to the plane of its orbit.
I see.
So, and so.
It's pretty big, too.
Yeah, it's big, but, you know, see, obviously, you know, one of those three objects was big enough that it could slam into even something as big as Uranus and tip it over on its side. And, you know, you were kind of wondering about all the moons and stuff. all of Uranus's moons and its rings and everything are all in that tipped over plane. I mean, they all get gravitationally eventually drug with it. I mean, initially when things slammed into it, it was probably pretty chaotic, but it's all settled down. So this whole grand system is just tipped on its side now. Everything orbiting in that equatorial plane of Uranus, but it's all tipped, what is it, 97 degrees or something like that. Tipped past 90. Okay, see, so technically then it's retrograde, see?
Yeah. That's two.
Its thumb is not up, its thumb is down. The third one is you actually see the object. One of those three objects we could go land a spacecraft on. It's the one big moon of Neptune, Triton. Triton is in a retrograde orbit about Neptune. Yeah, it's the only large moon that doesn't orbit prograde. It's one of those three objects. Okay, and the story is more complex than that. As it was, loose in the solar system, it slammed into Pluto, broke it apart, and then got captured by Neptune.
Where's the other half?
No, Pluto got broke apart. Right, that's why Pluto is kind of this double planet, and it has some debris around it.
Misshapen.
Yeah, and Pluto, now we have nice, really close-in pictures of it, you can see it's had a very tortured past, a lot of it has been resurfaced. I mean, it was split apart and formed back into two spherical blobs again, it and its moon, right? And so they're going to have, there's some of it that would have gotten not so remelted, and some of it that would have gotten totally melted and had to cool off again, settle in.
And that was Triton that hit it?
Triton, I'm pretty sure, hit it. I mean, I'm speculating here, but I don't think it's very far off, because you look at Triton, we've got close-up pictures of Triton now too. It's got this massive scar on it. Most of it has been resurfaced again, because it's slammed into Pluto. And so it's just
bounced off.
and of course it knocked Pluto a little bit out of the out of the plane of the ecliptic. So Pluto is kind of tipped up in its orbit about the sun, and it's split apart. Into two big objects and some debris. Yeah. And it all just seems to fit.
You can explain.
There's three holes.
Because of the revelation.
There's three objects. The other thing, out there in the Pluto neck of the woods, there are some fairly large objects. Some of those were probably the original moons of Neptune. Because when Triton came in, the other moons got flung off, the smaller moons. And so some of those things are probably former moons of Neptune. Because basically with Neptune, all you have is Triton and one other thing and some little stuff. It basically cleared the deck of all the other moons, when it got captured. Because it's bigger than Pluto. Triton is bigger than Pluto.
Wow.
It's a big object. Yeah. Now, Pluto would have been bigger if you put it all back together again. Yeah. It's a big object. Now, you wouldn't expect these to be giant, these three things that are being captured. They're not going to be giant planets, because they're way out in the outskirts. They're the outermost three planets, probably, or close to it, around the Angana system. I mean, obviously, some of the planets would have been on the opposite side of the whole story.
It's another problem with Venus. It doesn't follow the taper.
Right. Venus doesn't follow the taper.
Mercury's not that big either.
No.
At the end of the taper is where the smaller planets,
right,
being in the middle, are bigger.
Yeah.
Venus is the exception.
Yeah. And plus it's retrograde. And it's messed up internal dynamics. It all seems very tidy. We know enough about the solar system now that you've got the basic lay of the land, and coincidentally there are three holes. And there are three objects that made those three holes. So now the fun thing is, what if you went to Triton and got a rock and did a radiometric date?
Yeah, let's date the rock.
What would that thing be?
Because it would have come from
now. Of course, a lot of it is ice. You know, I mean, you know, with some of those things, you know, they're mostly water ice. You know, but if you could get a rock, you know, that is actually something that who knows how long it's, you know, long ago it crystallized, you know, as an object going around the Angana system.
Yeah.
Core samples, anyone?
A little bit interested. You'd be more than interested.
You'd be more than interested in the radiometric date of this rock. you know, and think about, you know, who knows what you know, decay rates, you know, might have been and all the different parts, you know, of the galaxy that object has been. See, you know, the decay rate is a function of space and time.
Right. That environment might have been quiet and the daughters are all different.
Yeah. We can see stars, that, you know, that have atoms in them, you know, that are visible from light years away, like that star is, that are completely unstable here.
Right.
They're obviously stable over there.
Just sitting there.
you know, so when you think about the Angana system lumbering through the galaxy here, and, you know, I mean, some of this stuff going around it could be, you know, very ancient,
really
trillions and trillions of years old, you know, and stuff. Okay, so lots of fun little side tracks you can take as you think about this.
Nebadon was just a twinkle in
God's eye. Yes. Long before anyone...
All time.
Long before... as they say there, long before Inspector number... What was he? 811,307 discovered this whirl in the force charge.
Yeah,
yes.
He was a twinkle.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, the reason I belabored that a little bit is, you know, you want to put the revelation to the test. I mean, they tell you the only way you can know it's a revelation is experientially. You got to try to refute it. I mean, if they tell you something like that, if you can't immediately find three holes in the solar system, you know this is a piece of crap in your lap. I mean, that someone just made up. I mean, that they can't tell you that. That has immediate consequences. You got to be easily be able to point at those three holes in the solar system, you know, or you've just immediately refuted it. Well, it's like I said, I mean, they can't just tell you they're secondary midwares.
Well, that
has consequences. And unlike OmniFim, I mean, how can I refute OmniFim? Right. But I can refute the existence of secondary midwares. If they're secondary midwares, we've got to have some evidence of that fact.
You heard the story of the three deep holes, haven't you?
What was that?
You've heard the story of the three deep holes, right?
The three deep holes? No, what?
Well.
Okay. sigh. Okay.
That was a retrograde.
Yeah, but are they as deep as a black hole? okay. Anyway. All right. So sure enough, so, you know, you should get all excited when they say something like, "Ooh, I can actually put that to the test." You know, let's see if that holds up to my scrutiny. You know, and the more you look at it, it's like, oh, I'll be danged.
Well, when they wrote this, we maybe didn't have all the information we have today, right?
Yeah, we don't have all the information we have today. Definitely. You know, we certainly didn't have all the high-resolution pictures of Triton and Pluto and stuff like we just got, you know, in recent years. And,
yeah, you're right. It's kind of
cool. Right. See, so it's just, the stuff is just right there to recognize. And seeing that, I mean, even though technically our scientists should know that those are three foreign objects, you know, or the marks of three foreign objects, it's sort of just like, well, no, it was a very chaotic thing, and I guess somehow or other, it's like, no. If it formed like you said, there wouldn't be any retrograde. And there certainly would be something as big as Triton that's retrograde and visible.
Plus, add the angle difference.
Not to mention, you know, Uranus tipped on its side, and you know, Venus, you know, rotating in the opposite direction. I mean, yeah, but you know, they can explain to you where that came from, right? And you know, which we can't know. all right. One more paragraph here.
All of the solar system material derived from the sun was originally endowed with a homogeneous direction of orbital swing, and had it not been for the intrusion of these three foreign space bodies, all solar system material would still maintain the same direction of orbital movement. As it was, the impact of the three Angana tributaries injected new and foreign directional forces into the emerging solar system, with the resultant appearance of retrograde motion. Retrograde motion in any astronomic system is always accidental and always appears as a result of the collisional impact of foreign space bodies. Such collisions may not always produce retrograde motion, but no retrograde ever appears except in a system containing masses which have diverse origins.
Okay. I told you that. They would say that. And notice the other little thing, subtle thing that they're reminding you of there. So you think about all those, you know, tiny little moons of outer moons of Jupiter that are retrograde. It doesn't immediately mean that literally that object used to be going around the Angana system and now is going around Jupiter.
That's what you just said. Now,
it may be that one of these big objects, you know, came in and upset things, could have gotten some little object that used to be going prograde into a retrograde mode, you know, because you're dropping big rocks into the pond and stuff splashes all over, you know. And so some of those may be, you know, not directly, you know, retrograde because of Angana, but because of the three objects messing up little stuff. Okay.
But you can't have a motion that's different.
But no matter how tiny the object is, there's no way it's going to get into a retrograde motion except for some foreign object coming into the system. No other way. Because angular momentum is conserved. notice they devoted the whole final bottom line paragraph of the section to that. You know, they're basically screaming at you, guys, what on earth are you thinking? I mean, how can you continue to believe that your solar system formed like you say it did? It's all just this singular angular momentum phenomenon. It obviously didn't. Why is the ecliptic not coplanar with the sun's equator? And where did all the retrograde come from? You know, it's junior high level stuff that the greatest minds alive don't seem to be impressed by for some reason. You know? And again, it kind of speaks to how, no matter how smart we are right now, we are pre-primitive. I mean, really, these things are a primitive sort of a recognition. And we're not recognizing them. We're with all of our intellect, we've bottled it up into a pre-primitive worldview that is just blind to trivially self-evident things.
Yeah.
And as it is in the solar system physics here, so it is in every other discipline of human endeavor.
Yeah.
Great minds bottled up in tiny little false worldviews. Remember that one passage in the book, how sad they are that when great minds willingly put themselves in little boxes?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. God made the solar system in how many days?
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, it's getting to the point where the so-called religious stories of the Earth's, the universe's formation are more logical than the brilliant minds' scientific stories. Their stories are more magical than the simple little kindergarten stories that religionists, you know, have told themselves for centuries. I mean, you know, like I've said, I mean, if you have to pick between the magic man and magic matter, you know, for the origin of the universe, the magic man is more logical than the magic matter. At least the magic man does a magic thing that's somewhat causal. He says, let there be the universe, and there is. Magic matter just magically makes the universe with no causality at all.
Right. Makes the magic man go away. Right. It's just magic by itself.
Yeah. Many religionists are unwitting secularists.
Yeah.
They think that the fundamentalist religionists are the primitives, you know, people that, you know, that you have the right to ridicule. No. The primitive people are the pre-primitive people, the most brilliant minds on the planet, who believe gibberish. Those are the ones, you know, that should face public scorn. Not some simple little faint flicker of faith that has a little kindergarten idea of the universe and of God. Why are you pounding on a little child of God? And you think you have the right to? How about that self-righteous blob of protoplasm that believes all this illogical stuff about magic matter? He's the one that should face some ridicule in the town square, not the poor little faint flicker of faith. And you know, so, you know, we've really messed up, you know, that we've got sophisticated religionists that think they, you know, that think that the side of the line to be on is with the, you know, the secular scientists and stuff. Yeah. No. 180 degrees. Everything has flipped 180 degrees here. Sorry, got off of my soapbox a little bit there, but it's annoying. You know, it's not right. You know. Everyone knows that story about, you know, what should happen to you if you take the little child of God astray, right? It'd be better if a millstone were hanged about your neck and you were cast into the sea. It's not right. Shouldn't be doing that. The self-righteous, you know, guy could use a sledgehammer, you know. Not the poor little child of God. All right, so we got kind of the stuff roughed out, and now they're going to get into a little bit more methodical story. You'll see, you know, as you flip into the next section, we start to get a series of dates. You know, they're going to start stepping us through a story now.
In the meantime, while this is happening over billion and a half years, mm-hmm. about, throughout the rest of the nebula, or Andromeda. All other solar systems being formed in other different
all ways. Kinds of other ways,
at the same time, or have already been formed. So
it's yeah, right. I mean, you know that, you know, some of the stuff that was way out in the outer parts of the Andromeda Nebula formed suns that got stable planets that didn't get disrupted and were inhabited probably 200 billion years ago.
So when they talk about, you know, Michael coming out and beginning to start things up around 200 or 300 billion years ago, and they're talking about it in the context of, you know, our particular nebula, and because we're now realizing that that nebula only spawned maybe 1/10 of, mm-hmm. or 1/9 of, right. you know, the size of it, so that it wasn't necessarily the progression of our nebula only that caused him to come out 200 or 300 million years ago. It's probably the progression of everything else all around it,
right.
in all of Nebula.
Exactly. Yeah, you see, and I tried to stress that as we're going through that, you know, so that really sinks in. But obviously, there.
And it doesn't necessarily mean put the, you know, his Salington in the vicinity of that nebula necessarily.
No, yeah, okay. Very unlikely. See, that Salington is, you know, close to, you know,
anything.
Anything Andromeda. Yeah, but like I said, when we talked about that before. Yeah, it has to be the case that there can be wildly different states of evolution across Nebadon.
Right.
It has to be kind of all in this roughly the same mode. But there's definitely going to be parts of like the Andromeda Nebula stuff, you know, that wasn't even remotely close to being ready to be inhabited when other parts, you know, were way ready. I mean, there was probably some stuff, you know, that was already basically in the Milky Way galaxy, but wasn't being used for any local universe yet, and was very settled, and it got incorporated in Nebadon. I mean, it probably had planetary systems, you know, that had been there for ages and ages and ages, you know, just didn't know life because no one had, you know, it wasn't part of a local universe yet. Okay. Right. See, so there were some worlds that were very, very old before life was implanted on them. Yeah. Our world, life was implanted on it the second that you could start the process.
Right.
But there's probably worlds, see, it's, you know, the world might have been there for a trillion years before they, you know, they put inhabited life on it.
And could have been around that long?
Yeah. They, yeah. Could have been around a lot longer than that. Yeah. Could have been around for trillions and trillions and trillions of years.
A
single planet.
Like we're saying, sounds we might like find out. I mean, if we had a rock temple from Triton, we'd probably be spooked crazy from the age dating.
See, and the reason it could be is because stars have time scales of trillions of years, not billions of years, like we think.
Oh.
See, so a natural, unmodified system could have been around for a long, 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 long time before any beings came there and said, oh, let's set up shop here. You know?
Yeah, you can have a super universe clock on some of that stuff, not just the local.
Stuff yeah.
Just happened recent.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Anyway, we better wrap it up. So, yeah, like I said, so next time we'll start kind of stepping forward more methodically in the story here. Let's take a moment here, everyone.